Good morning. As Christy mentioned, I and my husband were in South Africa from the beginning of apartheid until its end. And I just want to talk about that experience, especially when we were young and tried to get theatre going in a black suburb, township outside Johannesburg. Let me explain that apartheid was introduced in 1948 and implemented by an elected white nationalist government whose policies maintained white domination and the segregation of blacks. It's shocking, but apartheid lasted over four decades until 1991, when Nelson Mandela was released from his infamous prison on Robben Island, and his party, the African National Congress, was democratically elected by all the people of South Africa. Now, I was just finishing high school when apartheid began, and I was thankfully still there, an older woman, to see and celebrate Mandela's victory. Yet today, an even much older woman, when I look back to those apartheid years, the people I knew in my 20s, they are lost, a lost generation. Even today, 40 years later, I still see them in memory, the young black journalists, Louis Nkosi and Nat Nakaza, and the beautiful white poet activist, my good friend Ingrid Jonka. Their faces have become clearer, their voices grown louder, demanding to be heard, and their lives of protest in the dire situation of apartheid South Africa need to be remembered and honored. To go back to the beginning, I was a young woman who lived all my years of growing up in South Africa. My parents were divorced. My father was a Dutch-speaking Afrikaans doctor. He'd met my mother, who was Irish, in Dublin. They were divorced. I lived with my Irish mother. I attended Catholic schools. And I was a regular white South African. I accepted that blacks did the menial jobs. They cleaned my room. Waiters served me at restaurants. And I was totally indifferent to the sea of black faces that I saw on the streets of Cape Town. Yet all that would change when I met my husband. He was a very different kind of South African. He recognized the pain on the faces of the dark-skinned races on the streets. He even intervened when he saw a black man being beaten up and insulted by white teenagers. That violent incident changed his life and also mine. He protested against the apartheid laws, and over the years of the regime, our house would be searched by the police and his passport removed by the government so that he could no longer travel abroad. But going back to the beginning again, we lived in Cape Town. We tried to put on plays with white actors, but there was something not right about it all. And we decided to go to Johannesburg. We were in our early 20s, we were two young writers, and we wanted to create a theatre that was about black lives and black voices, because we felt that black lives mattered. And we'd heard from liberal friends that the township of Sophiatown, outside Johannesburg, was different to other townships. It wasn't just a poverty-stricken slum filled with crime and political unrest, but it was a black community where, totally unexpectedly, there was a resurgence of culture. It was a home to jazz musicians, and there were also emerging young black writers. We also knew that in coming to Sophiatown, we would be on the fringes of white society, and that we would be working and writing in a state of siege. I have to mention the harsh new laws that had been passed that kept the races apart. Blacks were confined to the poverty-stricken townships, while whites lived in comfortable suburbs. And there were terrible laws that made sex between the races punishable by a jail sentence and shaming in the press. And ridiculous as it may sound, blacks were forbidden to buy liquor. That was the way it was. And blacks were forced to live in the townships on the fringes of the towns and even villages in South Africa, if they could get jobs in the areas. If there was no work, then very often the shacks of the urban blacks were bulldozed and the people were forced to move to remote and unproductive areas. But unlike other townships, Sophiatown was very close to the suburbs of whites. It was considered a black spot in Johannesburg's white world. It was still one of the few areas where blacks could own property, but services were virtually non-existent. There was single tap. There was no water in your shack. You had to carry it in buckets if you wanted to wash. A shower was out of the question. And there were outside toilets, and they served whole blocks of humble shacks. I vividly remember that first visit to Sophiatown. I was terribly anxious, and when the lights of Johannesburg faded, my heart palpitated. I knew what we were getting ourselves in for. Whites were rarely seen in the townships. There were even incidents where whites were stoned by blacks. But we were taking the chance. We left the freeway, and our car was soon bumping along a rough and stony dirt road. And then there was the police checkpoint. But we were lucky. The officers waved us on, believing that in the darkness, we were just a car of blacks. They didn't care. And once inside the township, there were no street lights. But out of the dimness, I began to see the life of the township. Dim rows of corrugated iron shacks, plumes of smoke that rose up from coal-burning fires, stumbling figures, animals too, donkeys, yapping dogs, and even goats. And then, to my surprise, dark faces were pressed against the car window, men and women with bright eyes. They seemed to ask, "Who are you, you white people?" And finally, there was the incredible sound of jazz, music everywhere. It was amazing. But then I said to my husband, "We have to find it." We were looking for the shack of our contact, a man called Bloke Modisadi. We had to meet him. We found it, Bloke's place, his number 56, hammered to his door. Even as we struggled to find that door, people stumbled past us, some drunk and staggering. A hungry, yapping small dog was snapping at my feet. And there he was, Bloke Modisadi, and he shouted a welcome from his shack door. If it was a door, it was a corrugated sheet of metal that he held open for us. Then, with a gesture to his cramped yard, he cried out, "Welcome to Sunset Boulevard." And we knew that we had arrived. I remember it so clearly, Bloke's shack. Well, it was a kitchen and a living room that served both purposes. I was surprised to see that there was a large refrigerator in the room, as well as comfortable chairs and colorful cushions. Then Bloke, our generous host, proceeded to show us his amazing collection of jazz records. And I realized that Bloke, he was just like us. He was well informed, not only with politics, but also music, as well as the latest novels. And then, to my astonishment, he proceeded to serve us dry martinis. Suddenly the room and the music, together with the martinis, suggested a sophistication that seemed impossible in this township, while outside there was the poverty, violence, and always the political unrest. Then it all changed. Bloke poured himself a glass of brandy, and then, leaning forward, he talked about the defiant political situation in Sophiatown. He angrily spoke about a police raid that had recently taken place. The government had sent in 2,000 police armed with guns and clubs, and the forced removals of the residents of Sophia Town had begun. He recalled that it was a brutal day. The rain was pouring down. It was cold. He said, "It hurt me so much to see black families with a few possessions just dumped into military trucks. Our people screamed when they were driven off to distant meadowlands. Nobody wants to live there, too far away. No work, it's not a home, just a bleak and unwelcoming place." My glass was empty. There was only a bitter, dry taste in my mouth. I felt that I had glimpsed the underbelly of Sophia Town, with all its violence and the brutal police oppression. Yet, to my astonishment, the music still played on, and there was laughter out on the streets. The heart of Sophia Town still beating. Then our work began. Over the coming weeks, with blokes' help, we found black men anxious to tell their stories. I recall Stephen, a teacher, serious, Dan, with a great sense of humor, who was a trade union official. And there were others with little education, a man who had worked on South Africa's gold mines, others who had even dug out on the roads. Some were gardeners for the white homes, but all were frustrated and angry and eager for a chance to speak about their lives on a stage. And so our rehearsals began, or our discussions, our preparations. We sat in a circle on upturned boxes in a dingy church hall, and we talked about our lives, our personal experiences. And during those sessions, I got some insight in what it meant to be black and living and struggling in a township. The exchange between us often came in angry outbursts from the men at some recently experienced insult or injustice, one man being arrested because he didn't have his ID document, another one who complained of working in the white man's garden and never getting paid. And so their indignities and sufferings were voiced. And there was also humor in these anecdotes about their survival strategies. I soon recognized that laughter was as important as anger in their lives. There were weeks of working with these men who tried to find words, whose accents were rough and whose sense of outrage was easily aroused. These black men desperately wanted to be actors and give voice to their lives, no matter how broken and desperate they felt. But for me, there were some moments of isolation. I felt that I'd left the white world, and I longed to speak about things that mattered in my life, like having a home one day and a family. Yet I knew that my comfortable white life meant nothing in this black township. These black men were the actors we worked with, and I recognized them as both friends and comrades. It was at these sessions that we met our other two black friends, Louis Nkosi and Nat Nkosa. They were both in their early 20s, and they were young journalists working on a new black newspaper called the Golden City Post. Louis and Nat were very different, and like bloke, surprisingly sophisticated. Louis was tall, thin, with soulful eyes. He was serious and talked intensely not only about politics, but also literature. Yet I could sense a deep reserve about him, as if he could not quite trust people. Nat, on the other hand, was very different, a young man full of smiles and jokes. He was welcome into the homes of many liberal households in Johannesburg. He laughed about everything, even the daily humiliation of just being a black man insulted in a white world. We often shared a meal at a township eating place, hot curry and cheap red wine. And I find it amazing now, but we often talked about Jack Kerouac and his book On the Road. We all agreed that Kerouac was an inspiration to us, even though We were just stuck in a black township. But we talked about being on the road in a very different South Africa of the future, where those apartheid laws would be gone, and we could all have a meal together in a fine Johannesburg restaurant. Lewis, with bravado, announced that he wanted to write a novel, and I believed him. Later in his life, he did write that novel. But long after he had left Sophiatown and went into exile in Britain. After weeks of work, we got the play on the stage, and our actors, the men of the township, had a chance to share with an audience of familiar events. And they spoke about the township removals that were disrupting their lives. This was the beginning of theatre. The audiences were small, a few stout black women, some children, a few men. Yet people listened. This was their lives. Then it all changed. In 1958, the unthinkable happened. The bulldozers finally moved in and destroyed the last of the shacks. Already, a new low-income white suburb called Triumph was waiting to be built on the fringes of Johannesburg, where Sophiatown had stood. It was as if Sophiatown had sunk down into the earth and was lost forever. Now only in my dreams do I ever find Sophiatown again. It was over. I returned with my husband to the coastal town that was far from Johannesburg. Yet I was changed when I left Sophiatown. The voices of Bloke, Lewis and Nat and so many others followed me. The play was staged, but it is those memories of those men, our friends, that remain for me. It seemed even more important now that black lives matter, not only in apartheid South Africa, but also here in the United States. But let me go back to our friends. Bloke was the first to leave. He remained bitterly until after the shacks were gone. I recall that he said to me, "I can no longer bear this pain. I have to get out of this place, find another country." And he did. Bloke left South Africa on a one-way ticket, an exit permit that would never allow him to return to his homeland, South Africa. He got a job in London, acting, but then, even more restless, he travelled on to Germany, and somehow he found his voice there. He married a German woman, and he wrote a powerful memoir. His voice echoes now from the words of that book, "Blame Me on History." And Christy will read that section.
The impressive parade began. Mounted patrols, marching detachments, and military convoys. In a resplendent show of arms, it was a magnificent sight, an august show, dazzling in military ritual, brass buttons, and military drill never fail to draw a crowd. We lined the street to watch, with silent awe, the spectral parade. We did not cheer or wave flags. We stood there, spellbound, transfixed by a stately, slow, and solemn funereal train. There was a promise of death, and we could sense the horror in that promise. And yet we could not turn our faces aside or turn our backs to it. Then suddenly, as if in fulfillment of that promise, an order was shouted through the loudspeakers. The people were given 3 minutes to disperse. But the people mumbled and shuffled their 3 minutes away. "Disperse the crowds," the order boomed through the loudspeaker, and the South African police went into a kind of action for which they deserve and earn medals. The mounted police steered their horses into the crowds, galloping into men and women, charging into mothers with children strapped on their backs. Screaming women and children were running from one horse and baton into another. Men were collapsing under baton. Wallops, falling to the ground before the galloping horses. I saw a mounted policeman charging in the direction of a woman running for shelter, heard her terrified scream as she fell under the horse, the rider almost falling off his mount from the sheer force of the blow. He had meant to cudgel her, but had missed.
Nat would follow a bloke in leaving South Africa. He went on to work as a very successful journalist for mainstream Johannesburg newspapers. Then he was offered a Nieman Fellowship to study at Harvard. He was anxious to accept this fellowship, and he applied for a passport. But like Bloke and many other black intellectuals, the government refused. If he was to go to Harvard, he had to accept the grim exit permit, knowing that he could never return to South Africa. He took that exit permit. But on arriving in the United States, Nat enjoyed all the freedom of a democracy, but the past haunted him. And he soon found that racism existed in the U.S., even though it was a lot more subtle. Nat completed his fellowship at Harvard, but he was homesick, and even in Harlem, when he returned to New York, he felt little connection with the black struggle there. He became depressed, unsettled, and drinking. He knew that he would never return to South Africa. In a moment of loss and despair, Nat threw himself from a high building in Harlem. His life was over. He was buried in Harlem, very near Malcolm X. He left nothing that we can read today. Then Lewis left, too, and his departure was also on that terrible one-way exit permit. But Lewis was more successful. He was sardonic and academic. He was soon teaching in London and married an English woman. He finally settled in Switzerland, where he became a professor of African studies. And Lewis did write that novel. It was titled Mating Birds, and Christy will read that extract.
A few months before my last year at the Lutheran Seminary, rumors began to travel from the white town of Mazimba that a whole village was to be moved to an area 50 miles inland to make way for a new white settlement. At first, people did not believe what they had heard. These, after all, were Zulu ancestral lands where generations upon generations had buried their dead in the blood of Zulu warriors long before their final conquest by the white men had mingled with the red soil of the valleys and the Zulu plains. But when the Bantu commissioner, a tall, thin man with a long hawk-like nose dividing a pair of green eyes, arrived from Oshawa, bearing papers signed with indelible government ink, there was no longer any doubt as to the seriousness of the situation. Without plans and without organization, a few reckless people spoke of the need to resist, of the need to fight back if necessary, but there was too little time to unite our people into a strong force. The day the soldiers came to the village with bulldozers, people were standing around in little knots, watching with disbelief, their huts and cattle enclosures quickly razed to the ground, the little they owned being loaded on military trucks. Some of the soldiers were not content to leave it at that. In a show of force that was entirely unprovoked, they went about breaking up clusters of individuals who silently watched the remorseless destruction of their ancient village. Those who murmured complaints were quickly beaten up or arrested for obstruction. A few faces were slapped, and it was not long before the people were forced to scatter at the sound of shots being fired repeatedly above their heads in an obvious attempt to frighten them. My father had moved the entire family to my maternal uncle's village 20 miles away from Mazimba in order to avoid attempts to corral us with the rest of the people who were to be dumped into a government-protected village. But all my relatives, old and young, had returned to watch the soldiers, armed with rifles, lay devastation to the mud huts and the cattle kraals. 2 weeks later, when my father died suddenly without any warning, my mother, in her bitter lamentations, claimed that the grief and despair, not old age, had killed him.
Just as I had heard of Nat's death in New York, another voice would return to haunt me. This was the poet Ingrid Jonker, a young, white, Dutch-speaking woman. I had known her from bohemian parties in Cape Town when I was a college student and lived there. Her father had been a member of the apartheid government, and she rebelled against his views. She did not write in English, but rather in the Dutch Afrikaans language. Ingrid, like myself and others, was shocked by the violent protest in the black townships in the 50s and 60s and the police brutality. She wrote a moving poem about the death of a black child killed by police gunfire in the township violence. But Ingrid's life became too much to bear. Deeply depressed, she made two desperate phone calls to friends who were out for the evening. Unable to receive help, she left her home, drove to the beach in Cape Town, walked across the sand, and went into the waves and just swam out and never came back. She ended her life by drowning. Yet Ingrid is not forgotten, and neither is her poem of the black child whom she chose to join in death. When Nelson Mandela was released after 37 years in prison, he read Ingrid's poem during his address at the opening of the first democratic South African parliament in 1994 in Cape Town. Ingrid's voice joins now with those of Bloke, Nat, and Lewis. They are with us, voices that remind us that black lives matter, both during the long years of apartheid and also here in our community in the United States. Christy will read Ingrid's poem.
The towns mentioned in the poem are the towns where children were shot. The child is not dead. The child lifts his fists against his mother, who shouts, "Africa!" Shouts the breath of freedom and the veld in the locations of the cordoned heart. The child lifts his fists against his father in the march of the generations, who shouts, "Africa!" I shout the breath of righteousness and blood in the streets of his embattled pride. The child is not dead, not at Langa, nor at Nyanga, nor at Orlando, nor at Sharpeville, nor at the police station in Philippi, where he lies with a bullet through his brain. The child is the dark shadow of the soldiers on guard with rifles, Saracens, and batons. The child is present at all assemblies and law givings. The child peers through the windows of houses and into the hearts of mothers. This child, who just wanted to play in the sun at Nyanga, is everywhere. The child grown to a man treks through all Africa.